Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, recording at our Hideaway studio in East County. Today we open our show with news about May Day marches for workers' rights here in San Diego and around the world. Then on our Capital Report, learn why a trip to Italy, jewelry store purchases, and other big expenditures charged by Congressman Duncan Hunter's campaign have prompted a watchdog group to call for an FEC and a congressional ethics investigation. We also have a warning today for parents and anybody who uses those colorful laundry pods, since it turns out they've caused thousands of poisonings in children. Next up, we'll have a heartwarming story about a man who has been missing for 10 years, and now he's been found in Lemon Grove and reunited with his family, thanks to an Identify the Missing Day recently held by the County Medical Examiner's Office, with help from law enforcement agencies countywide. Spring is rattlesnake season, and we'll have some tips for you on what you should know before hitting the trail to stay safe from snake bites. Then on our local government report, we'll tell you about some hot items affecting East County that are coming up on the agendas this week for the County Board of Supervisors, Lakeside's Community Planning Group, and the Lemon Grove City Council. We'll also have results of a new hospital safety report, so stay tuned to hear what grade local hospitals received. Our newsmaker interview today is with Tim Cass, who started planting pines and other conifers on his property in Boulevard's Tierra del Sol neighborhood over 3 decades ago. He'll tell you how he's grown an entire forest on former chaparral land using very little water, much of it harvested from fog and mist, a system that's now got the attention of the U.S. Navy. From Public News Service, we'll have some national news stories next, and then, on sports, Liz Alper will have the results on Game 3 of the Padres-Dodgers series. Today we'll be replaying our interview with Don Axe, giving tips on urban farming, and you won't believe how much he's growing on his small backyard farm in Spring Valley. Then on Green Scene, hear what animal has just been declared our national mammal by Congress. Then we'll have some tips for you from Cal Fire on getting ready for wildfire season. And finally, we'll take you on the road to the old Campo Stone store, thanks to the County News Service, to hear some fascinating long-lost history from the area's colorful past, along with an unsolved mystery. So stay tuned for all of these stories and more on today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show, where East County matters. May Day on May 1st is a traditional celebration of spring, but it's also International Workers' Day, a time when labor unions and workers around the world unite to stand up for workers' rights. Thousands rallied in major cities around the world this weekend. Here in San Diego, hundreds of labor and Latino rights group members staged a peaceful march from Chicano Park to Barrio Logan with the theme, Workers' Rights Have No Borders. The participants called for living wages, equal rights for women, and an end to deportations, also denouncing the growing wealth gap between the rich and the working poor across America. In Los Angeles, many marchers carried anti-Trump messages, protesting the presidential candidate's stances on immigrants. In some cities, however, May Day marches turned violent. 2 police officers in Seattle were injured and 7 people arrested after protesters threw rocks, bottles, and Molotov cocktails at authorities. In Istanbul, Turkey, over 200 people were detained, some for possessing grenades and other explosive devices, and in Paris, police used tear gas on a May Day crowd. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is Miriam Raftery. This is East County Magazine's Capital Report, bringing you the latest news and newsmakers from our nation's capital. This is Miriam Raftery with a Capital Report. CREW, which is Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington, has requested that the Federal Elections Commission, or FEC, conduct an audit into the campaign committee for Republican Duncan Hunter. CREW has also asked that the Office of Congressional Ethics investigate whether Hunter violated House ethics rules through thousands of dollars in questionable expenditures charged to his campaign. These include a Hunter family trip to Italy over Thanksgiving, charges to department stores such as Nordstrom's, an Italian jewelry store, and a company that provides uniforms for a school attended by Hunter's children. Crew found that over Thanksgiving weekend last year, Hunter and his family spent campaign funds on airplane and train tickets, hotels, and meals for a trip to Italy that included stops in Rome, Florence, Naples, and the resort town of Positano on the Amalfi Coast. Particularly suspect, according to Crew, was an expense listed as food and beverages that in fact was made to an Italian jewelry store, which has confirmed to the San Diego Union-Tribune that it does not sell food or beverages. Crew concluded, this spending, the timing of the trip over the Thanksgiving holiday, and photographs Rep. Hunter posted on his Facebook page suggest the trip was a family vacation. None of these expenditures, however, has been identified as personal or mistaken. The San Diego Union-Tribune reported that it had found two photos on Hunter's Facebook page from the trip taken at tourist destinations, and it published one of them. However, those photos apparently have been removed since then off of Hunter's Facebook page. Other questionable expenses exposed by Crew include charges in 2015 to stores including Nordstrom's, Macy's, Barnes & Noble, and Educational Outfitters, the school uniform company. The campaign has claimed that these purchases were for contributions to local charitable organizations. Crew also raised questions over hefty cable and internet service bills at Hunter's home, which does double as his campaign headquarters, and payments to Hunter's wife, Margaret, who is his campaign manager. The newest revelations come on the heels of recent reports that Hunter's campaign inappropriately used campaign funds to purchase video games, tuition at his children's school, a new garage door, oral surgery, and items at a surf and skate shop. Congressman Hunter, after media published those expenditures, did pay back some $12,000 to the campaign. Hunter and or his campaign have offered a string of explanations for those prior expenditures, citing mistakes in bookkeeping, his teenage son using the wrong credit card in his wallet, overcharges on the credit card, and in the case of the oral surgery, the congressman has denied that any member of his family even had oral surgery done. The campaign has reportedly hired an outside law firm to audit spending and amended its disclosure reports for those previously reported items. Now, we did send an email asking Congressman Hunter's spokesman, Joe Casper, for a response to the Crew complaint and the new expenditures questioned by that group. So far, we have not received a reply. However, Mr. Casper did send an email to Patch.com stating, Crew is a leftist organization that is targeting Trump supporters. Hunter was among the first members of Congress to endorse Trump for president, but Crew has a long record of targeting both Democrats and Republicans embroiled in ethical issues. In fact, Crew's list of most corrupt members of Congress includes 5 Democrats and 11 Republicans. Crew's list of congressional members currently under investigation for ethics issues includes 6 Democrats and 4 Republicans. Its report on nepotism in Congress turned up 248 members whose family members benefited personally from their positions, and that included many in both parties. While Crew did recently raise issues about Trump back in the 2008 election, Crew was calling on Hillary Clinton and others to release their tax returns for the public to see. Crew's website lists the organization as a nonpartisan, nonprofit group. Casper, however, told the Union Tribune, we don't owe Crew an explanation of what he might have done to involve official activities around any outside event or travel, regardless of whether his family was with him. He has previously said that campaign funds can be used for international travel expenditures under some circumstances, as well as buying donation or donor support items, as Casper says was the case here. Now, Hunter may not owe Crew any explanation, but he may well have to explain his campaign expenditures if the FEC or the House Ethics Committee takes up Crew's call for investigations. Federal regulations make clear that campaign funds may not be used for travel costs of trips that are primarily for personal or recreational purposes, though meal expenditures are allowable if any campaign activity occurs on the trip. Hunter's wife, Margaret, has received $116,000 for work as a campaign consultant, in addition to $14,000 in other reimbursements from the campaign, and that's over the last 6 years. The money included her $3,000 a month salary as campaign manager. The Hunter Campaign Committee did admit to $2,000 in overpayment to Mrs. Hunter, which it has indicated will be refunded, but it has stood by the remaining expenditures as legitimate campaign costs.
According to a new study in the journal Pediatrics, 17,230 children under the age of 6 have been accidentally poisoned by ingesting laundry detergent pods. In a 1-year period from 2013 to 2014, in all, 769 children were hospitalized, 30 went into a coma, and 2 died. The latest victim is a 7-month-old baby boy in Florida. Ingesting any form of laundry detergent, powder or liquid, would be poisonous. However, the pods have a chemical composition and concentration that is even more toxic. The pods are cheerfully colored and look like candy or toys. They're even scented. The pods have become popular since they were introduced by Procter & Gamble in 2012 for convenience and portion control. Parents of young children may wish to switch to conventional laundry detergents. If you do use laundry pods, they should be treated like all hazardous household products and kept out of reach if there are children living in or visiting the home. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Leon Thompson.
This is Miriam Raftery for the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ with a heartwarming story from County News Service. A man who's been missing for over 10 years has been found in Lemon Grove and reunited with his family, thanks to new information uncovered after San Diego County's first Identify the Missing Day was held in March. 79-year-old Thomas Gatewood, known as Randy to his family, vanished from his family's home in Yuma, Arizona way back in 2007. His family has been searching for him ever since. Over the years, they filed missing persons reports in Yuma and San Diego with no results. Then his niece, Carrie, who lives in San Diego, saw news coverage about Identify the Missing Day and called her father, Gene Gatewood, in Fountain Valley. Gene and Carrie came to the event and met up with National City Police Detective Lyderson Zeffirino, who updated the earlier San Diego missing persons report, adding new information and DNA samples. The detective uncovered a record showing that Randy had been admitted to Paradise Valley Hospital in National City back in 2011. Gene spent the next month trying to obtain his brother's medical records, and finally, on April 20th, he learned that Randy had been discharged to a skilled nursing facility in Lemon Grove, where he's been for the last 5 years, since he now has dementia. So on April 21st, Randy's brother and niece went there to see their long-lost family member. Gene says, "I honestly thought he was deceased. It's just miraculous that we were able to find him. We're just thrilled." Now, Gene didn't know how his brother would react. Staff at the nursing facility said Randy had mentioned a brother named Gene, but since his admission back in 2011, he's never had a visitor and he'd never left the facility. Gene and his daughter almost didn't recognize Randy when staff brought him in his wheelchair to meet them. And then Randy smiled. Gene asked, "Do you know who I am?" And Randy said, "You're my little brother, Gene Gatewood." Randy was lucid enough to recognize not only Gene, but also Gene's daughter, Randy's niece. The two told Randy that they'd been searching for him all these years. Gene says his brother looks better now than he did the last time they saw each other, thanks to the excellent care he's receiving for his medical conditions. Unanswered questions remain about where he was from 2007 until 2011, and Gene and his daughter will be working on finding those answers over time. But for now, they're just happy to have Randy back in their lives. Gene says his brother has major health issues, but his quality of life will be better now that he'll have family visiting. He adds, "We've already asked permission to take him on outings." He thanked the county for holding its Identify the Missing event that made his dream of finding his brother become reality. Carrie says the most the family was hoping for was to find her uncle's body and bring it home. Instead, she says, "Here we wound up getting to find him and bring joy to his final years. It is still unbelievable and amazing." Now authorities can close this missing persons case, one of more than 3,100 dating back to the 1950s that are active in San Diego County alone. That number is part of almost 20,000 missing persons cases in California. And there are also about 31 unidentified John and Jane Doe cases, that's unidentified bodies, statewide. These facts inspired the San Diego County Medical Examiner's Office to organize the first Identify the Missing Day, attended by every law enforcement agency in the region. The goal of the event was to help reunite families with their loved ones by updating missing persons cases and submitting DNA for testing. San Diego County Medical Examiner's Investigator Supervisor, Julio Estrada, called the Gatewood family case a story of success and a fulfillment of the event's main objective. About 20 families attended that March 19th event, filing 10 new missing persons reports as well as updating another 10 existing reports. It could take several months to find matches for those, and if so, those DNA results could help solve more cases in the future, bringing closure to more families like the Gatewoods.
Spring is a great time to head outdoors and enjoy picnics, hiking, or just a backyard barbecue. But be aware that it's also snake season, which peaks in April and May. Already this season, at least two East County residents, including a toddler, have required emergency medical treatment after being bitten by a rattlesnake. Here are some tips to stay safe from snakes. Yard debris, wood piles, gaps under homes, wooden decks, and cement patios can attract snakes. Basically, anything that attracts rodents will attract snakes. If you have outdoor water sources like a pond or even a pool, be mindful that snakes need water too, especially during a drought. Preventative tips include trimming shrubs, filling any ground gaps or holes, and removing nearby wood or brush piles near your home. It's best to keep bushes and shrubs 6 inches or less off the ground. This will make the snake feel less secure when trying to hide. As a general rule, if you can't see where your hands and feet are, there is the potential to be bitten. When hiking, stay on the trail. When rock climbing, never put your hands above you onto rocky ledges where snakes like to bask in the sun. If you hike with your dog, consider getting a rattlesnake vaccine for your dog. In rural areas or homes in canyons, check your yard for snakes before sending children out to play. Teach your children to stay calm if they see a snake and to tell an adult. If you do come across a snake, do not antagonize the snake. It is probably just passing through, so leave the snake alone. They generally will leave the area on their own accord. If you hear a rattling sound, that's a warning, so freeze, then slowly back away. If you are bitten, stay calm and dial 911. Lie down and keep the affected limb lower than the heart. Loosen tight clothing and remove jewelry on the affected leg or arm before it starts to swell. Although rattlesnake bites can be dangerous, nearly all victims will survive with prompt medical treatment. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Ed Barena.
This is Miriam Raftery with East County Magazine's local government report on the hottest hearings this week covering East County issues. The San Diego supervisors will meet Tuesday and Wednesday, May 3rd and 4th. There are several East County issues on their agendas. On Tuesday, supervisors will consider a Grossmont Union High School District request to extend the contract for educational services in sheriff-run detention facilities. And then on Wednesday, supervisors will consider exploring enhanced food service options for local breweries and wineries that could include catering services. They will also consider possible changes to aviation leases at the Ramona Airport. Out in Lakeside, the Community Planning Group will meet Wednesday at 6:30, and their agenda includes county presentations and possible votes on a Lakeside Equestrian Center, as well as tree removals on Julian Avenue. There will also be a hearing on proposed changes to the Terrace Hill Residential Development Project, and the Lakeside Community Planning Group, by the way, is seeking applicants to fill two vacancies for members on that board. Lemon Grove City Council meets Tuesday evening at 6 p.m., The council will vote on whether to approve Sandag's proposed transit funding ballot measure.
This is Leon Thompson with the Health Report. Does your hospital make the grade when it comes to safety? Now you can easily find out. The latest hospital safety score sheet is out, compiled by the nonprofit Leapfrog Group for hospitals nationwide. In San Diego County, the grades rank from A to C. Here in East County and San Diego's inland region, Kaiser Permanente scored an A rating. Sharp Grossmont received a B, while Alvarado Medical Center managed only a C grade. Countywide, other A-ranked hospitals include Scripps Memorial Hospital at La Jolla and Tri-Center Medical Center in Oceanside. The worst rankings in San Diego County, all C grades, went to Sharp Memorial and Paradise Valley, as well as Alvarado. But those are still better than the national average, and in some categories, even the C-ranked hospitals scored high. At Alvarado, the issues identified dealt mainly with communicating information about medication, as well as bed sores and certain infections. Grossmont's issues included its handling of breathing issues, as well as communications concerns. Kaiser, despite its A rating, could use improvement on communications about discharge, but got the highest possible rating for its computerized prescription system to reduce medication errors. To view full details on all hospitals in San Diego County, you can Google Hospital Safety Score or check the health section at eastcountymagazine.org.
You're listening to the East County Magazine radio show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, from the desert to the coast.
Now, straight from the headlines, bringing you our latest top newsmakers. This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, recording at our Hideaway studio in East County. My very special guest today is Tim Cass. Tim grew up in Spring Valley and La Mesa, exploring South and East County. He had an interest in botany that eventually earned him a degree in wildlife management at Humboldt State University. He came back to San Diego for the sunshine and graduated back when environmental impact regulations and species protection was just getting started. He's worked in environmental management and the botany field until he retired in 2012. Since the early 1980s, he's been planting trees on a vacant lot in Boulevard, where he has established an entire forest. Tim, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So how many trees are in your forest right now?
Right now, over 300 mature trees.
Wow, that's amazing. And this was chaparral land before?
Yes, in 1980 when we purchased it, it was a chaparral.
So how did you become so interested in botany and trees?
Well, I grew up in La Mesa and Spring Valley, and when I went to Monta Vista High School, I started exploring Southeast County, San Miguel Mountain, Otay Mountain, Humboldt area, and ever since then, I have had an interest in plants.
So where do you go about getting the trees that you plant on your property?
Well, it used to be the California Department of Forestry in the 80s used to sell trees to the public. These days, Cal Fire does not do that anymore. So a lot of the trees I planted in the 80s are now mature, producing pine cones and seeds. So I collect those and germinate those myself and use those to plant seedlings on my property.
Some of them are 30 feet tall, I understand.
Yes, a lot of them are the native pines, such as Coulter Pine, Jeffrey Pine, Incense Cedar, Big Gone Douglas Fir, and they all do very well once I get them established.
Very good. A lot of our readers are probably very interested in this because they've lost trees due to drought, bark beetles, and of course, the many wildfires that we've had through here. So what trees do you find do best in our climate, and how do you go about planting those?
Well, I found that the conifers, especially the native conifers like the Coulter pines, do well. The trick is getting them started from seedlings. And for me, what I have to do is irrigate them at least for the first couple of years, and I use drip irrigation.
Now, in the state park, the Rancho Cuyamacas State Park, it was really devastating after the Cedar Fire. They lost over 98% of the pine trees in the entire forest. And I know that they've tried to bring them back. How successful has that been?
It's really hard for me to tell. Their website I went to recently, and they have 70% success or more. But I've also talked to botanists who've been there who said that it's a very low success, so I really don't. No, you might want to get somebody from the state park, possibly on your radio show, to discuss that.
Yeah, we would love to do that if anybody from state parks out there is listening. That's a whole different issue. But certainly when you drive through, much of it still looks like a ghost forest. And it's really sad to see. So it's nice, I think, to see a pine forest being reestablished out there in a portion of East County. Now, I understand that you've done this with basically no water bill. Tell us how.
Several years ago, there's no electricity close by from gas and electric, so I've installed some solar panels and a solar pump in my well. Basically, I pump the water during the day. It's stored in a 10,000-gallon tank, and I have an overflow on the tank, which goes into my drip irrigation system.
So you're using solar electric water well pumping. To irrigate these trees.
Yes, I do that without any batteries. Basically, instead of storing the electricity, I store the water in a tank. And what overflows, I put into my drip irrigation system, and then I just change the drip irrigation system probably every 3 days.
Very cool. Now, something even more innovative that you're doing is you are harvesting natural fog, mist, and rain from storms to supplement that irrigation. That's fascinating. Tell us a little bit about what made you get into that and what exactly fog and mist harvesting involves.
Well, I noticed with my mature trees that in Tierra del Sol that often we get a lot of fog and clouds coming down, but we don't get as much rain. And I noticed under the trees I put some pans out, and I was getting twice as much water from fog drip and mist in the wind than I was getting in the rain gauge. So I've been putting out little screens and such. Mm-hmm. And it's fairly consistent that I get twice as much water from the screens. And I'm trying to find methods now of capturing that water over the seedlings with these screens. And they also protect the trees from rodents and rabbits as well. And I'm having some pretty good success with that. And I'm still trying to refine the method. So people who don't have water like I do and don't have drip irrigation may be able to establish trees without.
If you could kind of help our readers visualize what this looks like. I understand you're testing some sort of mesh. What kind of mesh and where does that go exactly?
Well, for me, normally to protect the trees from rabbits, you have these little tubular 4-inch diameter mesh you put around with big holes in it to see them protect them from rabbits. And what I've done is I purchased from the craft store a little mesh about the size of a piece of paper, and I put it inside the tubes. And I found that that mesh will basically collect twice as much water than falls it from normal rain on the seedling. So I'm experimenting with that now, seeing how much rain from the mist when the wind's blowing or the rain, actually how much dew or mist it collects. And it's consistently about twice as much during each storm. So I'm playing around with that to see if it's actually going to work with seedling establishment.
I think it's very cool that even in a place called Tierra del Sol, the neighborhood of Boulevard you live in, which means land of the sun, that there is enough mist and rain to grow a pine forest out there. Now, I'm told that the U.S. government has taken an interest in this, the military, for the Channel Islands out there, looking to maybe reestablish some trees using this fog drip system. Tell me about that.
Yes, I've been looking on the internet and literature, and I found that on the Channel Islands for their bishop pines and other conifers and oak trees, that they're finding out that most of those plants survive in this dry climate from the fog drip that the wind blows. So they're experimenting with meshes. Basically, they put up wide meshes like a fence, collect the water, and try to deliver it to the trees to try to get the seedlings established, similar like I do. And they found out that once the trees are larger, they collect the mist themselves. And once they're established, they're able to grow on their own.
Very cool. I mean, it sounds like this is a fairly low-cost method. Is that right?
Well, when you do the large mesh panels in the air and the tubes and the hoses, it gets expensive.
Which is not what you're doing, but what's
no,
been done
no, I'm trying to put the mesh around each tree with the protection from the rodents as well, and see if that works, and which is much less expensive. This may only work in certain locations. The problem here is when the plants, the seedlings need the water is the summer, and I haven't found out yet if this is going to work in the summer.
Well, we'll certainly look forward to hearing back from you with more information down the road as you go through some more seasons out there. I am very curious, now that you've reestablished this forest of pines and other conifers out there that are 30 feet tall, more than 100 trees, your own private forest, are you seeing that creating that habitat is also changing the wildlife? Are you seeing animals and birds come in that maybe weren't there before?
Well, also, since I put water out for the wildlife, I have lots of quail, coyote, bobcats. And the interesting thing about bobcats, I've actually had them breed.
So you have a family of bobcats now?
Yes, I've had them actually breed on my property. And the interesting thing about that is the cubs, when coyotes who will kill the cubs or eat the cubs come by, they now have trees which to hide in. And so I think the reason they're breeding on my property is because the cubs have a place to escape to when the predators come along. And they do. It's very interesting. They'll run up to and climb to the top of these trees where the coyotes can't get them. I think that's why they survive and why they breed on my property.
Very nice. I'm remembering that quote by John Muir where he talked about everything being connected to everything else in the universe. And it's really true. When you create the habitat, then you get the animals back, and that can really change the entire environment of an area. So I know you've told me that you're also seeing hawks, the large raptors, coming back as well. We're just delighted to hear that this is going on. Sounds like you're our own local version of Johnny Appleseed, except instead of planting apple trees, you're planting pines and other conifer trees. So keep it up, and we're going to look forward to an update in the future.
Well, thank you very much. And yes, I love it out there, and the trees are great for windbreaks, for shade, and attract wildlife as well.
Very good. So what's next? What innovations do you have on the horizon there?
Well, I'm still planting trees, seedlings. Since you cannot purchase the seedlings from the state anymore, I have to grow my own seedlings, collect my own cones, and I'm you know, I have plenty of water from my solar system and drip. I'm now going to keep experimenting with this mesh and try to read more literature. And I'm finding out around the world they're doing similar things in the desert areas in Chile and Yemen, mostly collecting fog for domestic uses, but I'm looking at more of the for reestablishing trees and forests. It seems that if you can get the seedlings established the first 2 years, that they will do well on their own, similar to like I've done on my property in Tierra. So first you have to reduce the competition, like I did, removing the greasewood, which is very flammable. Leaving some of the native manzanitas and other shrubs. And then once you get the trees established, if they're not too crowded, they grow on their own with no help, no extra help at all.
Very good. And you mentioned that you're experimenting to try to see if you can figure out a way to make that even more efficient so that perhaps eventually you won't need the 2 years of irrigation. Is that correct?
Yes, with a different screen and meshes and how tall, what size mesh. And the United States Geological Survey is, and Menlo Park is working on that as well. Channel Islands is doing research on that to reestablish their trees on the islands now that they've removed all the herbivores, the goats and the sheep and other animals. And yeah, it's very exciting.
Very good. Well, thank you very much for joining us today on the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice.
Thank you for inviting me.
This is KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, bringing you public interest news from our region.
The East County Magazine Show on KNSJ Radio is produced by the nonprofit Heartland Coalition. We're your community news. We reflect your interest, not special interest. You can get involved by volunteering, get trained to be a citizen journalist, and support East County Magazine at www.eastcountymagazine.org. And you can send your news tips and story ideas to editor@eastcountymagazine.org. Now stay tuned for part two of the East County Magazine radio show. The East County Magazine show airs Mondays and Fridays on KNSJ from 5 o'clock to 6 o'clock p.m. You can listen live at 89.1 FM or online at knsj.org. You can also listen anywhere by downloading the TuneIn application for your smartphone. For details, visit tunein.com. Next up, we have some top national news headlines for you from Public News Service.
Welcome to the Public News Service Daily Newscast for Monday, May 2nd, 2016. I'm Mary Sherman. Today's news features stories from around the nation. May Day marches highlight worker and immigrant rights, a circus company packs it up for pachyderms, and a Powerball promise to fund education appears to fall short in Kentucky. Leading our news, Aztec dancers set a festive mood in Seattle on International Workers' Day Sunday, an observance also recognized as May Day. Hundreds of marchers chanting slogans and carrying signs took to the streets of Chicago, calling for immigrant and worker rights and decrying what they see as hateful presidential campaign rhetoric.
What do you want?
Now!
When do you want it?
Now!
It was one of several events in cities to call for better wages for workers, an end to deportations, and support for an Obama administration plan to give work permits to immigrants in the country illegally whose children are American citizens. As May Day passes, unions in Oregon don't have much to cheer about. Eric Tegedoff has more on the link between the decline in unions and the rise in income inequality.
From 1984 to 2014, union representation declined by 40% in the state, according to analysis from the Oregon Center for Public Policy. Meanwhile, the gap between the top 20% and bottom 60% of income earners rose significantly. Janet Bauer of the OCPP says the issues of rising income inequality and declining union membership are tied together.
In industries that unions are prevalent, wages tend to be higher. And when representation declines, the bargaining power of those workers and all workers erodes.
Bauer notes industries where unions are historically prevalent, such as manufacturing, have been replaced by industries where unions are less popular, such as retail.
Authorities have found a sixth body following flash flooding in East Texas that also killed a woman and her four great-grandchildren. More than 7 inches of rain fell in less than an hour late Friday night, swamping a neighborhood and forcing some people onto their roofs. Farmers markets are in full swing in states around the nation, with tables full of locally sourced produce, meats, and crafts. And from North Carolina, Stephanie Carson reports on how land trusts are making sure shoppers can keep buying local.
In addition to water, sunshine, and sweat equity to create the bounty of crops, land also is needed to meet the demand. That's what North Carolina's land trusts bring to the table. They secure agricultural easements on farmland to protect it from development, explains Sharon Taylor with Mainspring Conservation Trust.
What that allows in a lot of cases is for some families to hold on to their property long term. It also allows for it to stay available for agriculture, which is, of course, important for the greater public because then the property is available for growing our food.
Mainspring holds the conservation easement for Ridgefield Farm, home of Brasstown Beef. By definition, an agricultural land easement prevents land from being used or sold for non-agricultural purposes.
Ringling Brothers Circus closed the curtain on the use of elephants in its shows with a final performance in Pennsylvania yesterday. Pressure's been mounting on circuses to end elephant acts. For the elephants, the traveling shows mean long hours of being shackled and confined in small spaces and the use of painful bull hooks for training them to do tricks. Lisa Wathney with the Humane Society of the United States calls the end of those practices cause for celebration.
Ringling Brothers' decision is monumental news and a very clear sign that times and public opinions are changing about the use of wild animals in circuses.
The circus decision to retire its elephant act now puts Ringling Brothers almost 2 years ahead of its own schedule for ending those performances. It's known as the Powerball Promise in Kentucky. Lottery money going to education, and state law requiring more than half of it to be used for need-based scholarships. But as Greg Stoltermeyer reports, lottery proceeds continue to be part of the budget tug-of-war at the state capitol.
For years, lawmakers have swept millions of dollars earmarked for the College Access Program and the Kentucky Tuition Grant Program into the state's general fund. Dustin Pugel with the Kentucky Center for Economic Policy says the General Assembly's new two-year budget was going to come close to meeting the statutory requirement before more than $40 million in line item vetoes by Governor Matt Bevin. Pugel says the changes will keep the state far short of full lottery funding for need-based aid.
The House and Senate had more or less fulfilled the Powerball promise, and with the veto of sections of HB 10, there are 22,000 fewer students who are going to be able to take advantage of those scholarships.
Bevin says the budget dedicates all available lottery proceeds entirely to education, as originally promised to Kentuckians. But Pugel says the final budget does not spend the lottery dollars as the law originally intended, instead redirecting funds to other education programs, including dual credit and work-ready Kentucky scholarships. Bevin says that is an appropriate use of lottery funds.
A new report suggests not only are we not alone in the universe, but many alien civilizations have come and gone. Researchers at the University of Rochester say based on the huge number of exoplanets we've already found, the odds that we're the only planet to support life are so slim as to not be even worth considering. Our civilizations existed for just about 10,000 years, and based on this, scientists think that a technological society of aliens would have likely come and gone in a short span of time on another planet, and that there were likely many of these civilizations, and will probably be many more. I'm Mary Sherman for Public News Service, member and listener supported, and online at publicnewsservice.org.
Tom and Colleen Taylor, two artists who recently relocated to Alpine from Arizona, are forming the Alpine Art League. Tom is a photographer specializing in wildlife, nature, architecture, and more. Colleen's fine art paintings include nature and wildlife, whimsical folk art, contemporary and abstract works. Now, this artistic couple is seeking local amateur and professional artists, as well as non-artists who love the arts and have skills in business or other areas, to join the Alpine Art League. They hope to launch open studio tours as well as art shows, bringing some culture to the East County Mountains. In Arizona, they ran a fine art studio and were active in the Arizona Art Alliance and the Sonoran Arts League, also serving on a planning committee for an annual art studio tour. In Alpine, they hope to create a league similar to the Sonoran Arts League, which believes artistic awareness is essential to life and community. They are also rolling out a new website at alpineartleague.org. And for more information, they can be reached at 619-609-8304, or you can email Tom and Colleen Taylor at thosetaylors@cox.net. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
This is Liz Alpert with the sports report for East County Magazine on KNSJ. The Padres were looking for the sweep of the LA Dodgers in the series finale in Tinseltown. Drew Pomeranz took the mound for San Diego and Clayton Kershaw for LA. The Dodgers sought to avoid the sweep. Kersh worked some pitcher magic in the third on a single that drove home A.J. Ellis, who had doubled, to give L.A. a 1-0 lead. A low-scoring game that was saved from being boring by Kershaw's inhuman pitching. The Dodgers avoid the sweep and win 1-0. Kershaw gets the shutout and the Dodgers break a 6-game losing streak, but the Padres take the series 2-1. The Padres are coming home tonight for a homestand against the Colorado Rockies and then the New York Mets. James Shields will take the mound to start tonight against John Gray for Colorado.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso. My very special guest today is Don Axe, and Don is the owner of Valley View Urban Farms in Spring Valley, and he's going to be telling us all about urban farming and homesteading, even in a small space, as we work to get back to our agricultural roots here in East County. Don, welcome to the show.
Good morning, Miriam. Nice to be here.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you. Now, listeners, a lot of you may not know that according to the Farm Bureau here in San Diego County, we have more small family farms under 10 acres than any county in America. That's right, more than Iowa or Kansas or Nebraska or anywhere else. So, Don, just how small is your urban farm?
Well, our urban farm is on a half an acre, and a lot of it is a slope, so we have maybe a quarter of an acre that we do all of our farming on.
Yeah, it's amazing. I was out and visited this, and I was just so impressed with how much you've been able to accomplish in a small space. So let's talk about, you know, some of the things you do there. But first, can you tell us a little bit about your background? How did you get into this?
Well, I was kind of born into it. My grandparents had a 20-acre farm up in Escondido, and they raised cows and horses and planted a lot of vegetables. So I couldn't wait to get up there and spend the summer with my grandparents growing up. And so it's kind of born into me, and I enjoy doing it my whole life, off and on. So I've been able to start this urban farm here in Spring Valley and be able to provide for family with organic products and some
extras to sell, as well as classes that you teach, and we'll be talking more about that in a minute. But first, tell us about the hydroponics. For those who aren't familiar with it, you raise vegetables and fruits both via hydroponics, which is essentially in water, and also soil grown in raised beds. What's involved in getting started in the hydroponics, and why do that? It seems a little bit counterintuitive since we're in a drought. How does that work?
Well, typically a hydroponic system will save about 95% water use over a ground or soil garden. So a lot of evaporation goes on with the soil. But with the hydroponics, it's pretty much a closed system. So we'll start our seedlings and put them in our hydroponic system, and within a month, they're completely grown and ready for harvest.
You were using what they call a floating bed for this?
A floating mat system, where it's insulation, a mat of 4x8 floating mat on about 6 or 8 inches of water.
Mm-hmm. And how big is the raised bed?
It's before 4 feet by 8 feet. Mm-hmm. So we can typically grow about 60 heads of lettuce in that area within a month.
Wow, that's amazing.
So very fast. We don't have to worry about weeds or gophers.
Instant salad bar.
Yes.
Okay. Now, in addition to that, you also have vegetables and fruits even growing in raised planter beds and just about everything else. Tell us about where you get your materials to build the beds from.
Sure. When I started this, I didn't have much money because 2008 came and I had a construction-related industry that was not going to be staying alive. So I was looking around to be able to start growing some things for our family and providing a healthy food for us. Mm-hmm. So a great source was a free list on Craigslist. So I would gather products and different things that people were getting rid of and not wanting to use. Also, there were a lot of homes in foreclosure where people were having to get rid of their animals and cages and different things like that. So I kind of gleaned off the land, and everything at the farm is made of a repurposed material.
Now, we're recording this in February, listeners. I was out there in January, and you had red ripe strawberries. Eat your heart out, East Coast folks, in the middle of the blizzard while we were out sampling strawberries.
Right. Yeah, that was in a vertical growing system that we had, basically a trash can with slices cut in the side around, and the strawberries would grow out of it.
Yeah, very innovative. Now, speaking of animals, you've also got all kinds of farm animals out there in that small space. Tell us a little bit about what you have.
Well, we have dairy goats, three female dairy goats, Beverly, Katie, and Sadie. We also have chickens that we raise for eggs.
Yeah, all different kinds. How many different types of chickens do you have?
We have about 8 or 10 different breeds, quite a variation of color and color of eggs. We'll get pink and blue and green and brown and white.
So Easter's coming up, listeners. You don't have to dye the eggs. Just get some chickens that lay them in colors. How interesting. You also have ducks and turkeys, I understand.
Ducks, turkeys, rabbits. The rabbits that we raise are Flemish Giant rabbits.
Adorable. How big is the Flemish Giant?
One of them is about 20 pounds. The world record right now for a Flemish Giant is 55 pounds.
Oh my goodness.
So that's quite the rabbit.
You sell those for pets if people want?
They make incredible pets. They're very docile. They get very large. And a friend of ours has one of them that we sold to them, and the rabbit sleeps with a girl at night in the bed.
Goodness. And gorgeous. And they don't bark, and they don't scratch?
No. They do chew on wires, though.
We've got to watch that. Yeah. But they're adorable. You also had a pot-bellied pig out there.
Right. Her name's Piglet, and she's our little farm pig. She'll greet you at the gate looking for food and follow you around, make sure you're doing everything that you need to do. So she's quite the funny pig. So.
Now, those of us that work in regular jobs talk about bringing home the bacon, but you really do that. I understand you have a second farm out in Hamul that's, what, about 3/4 of an acre?
Yeah, about an acre that we use. We also raise organic free-range chickens and free-range pork there. We do all the processing ourselves. When we process bacon, sausage, ham, we don't use nitrates or nitrites to preserve them. So it's do our own smoking. So they are good, healthy meat, and a lot of people are very impressed by them.
Yeah. And then right there at your backyard in Spring Valley, you've got a barn, and you do cheese making, as well as other products from the dairy goats that you raise from the milk. What else do you make?
Right. Well, we start off with the milk. Of course, it's all organic milk, so it's very healthy, which we do sell by the quart. And we process the milk into cheese, lotion, soap, ice cream. That's about all we'll use for. So
wonderful. I know my mother was raised on a farm in Texas years ago, and it's really a set of skills that have been lost largely in today's generation of kids growing up. But in her day, she said they raised absolutely everything they needed. They only had to go to town to buy coffee and sugar. Are we kind of seeing a reversal back to that trend, a little bit of interest in the new generation wanting to learn how to live off the land again, Don?
Yeah, I would hope to see that. We've come to a point where everything is so fast food and organized that's in a lot of ways unhealthy ways. So my focus has been providing healthy food and teaching people how to raise that themselves. And
yeah, speaking of the teaching, you do all kinds of classes out there at Valley View Urban Farm. Tell us some of the things people can learn if they sign up for the classes.
Sure. Our most popular one is cheese making. We'll learn to milk the goats right before we make the cheese. And within 2 hours, you'll come and make 3 different kinds of cheeses. And you can take home a product and samples and learn how to do that and do it yourself.
That sounds delicious. You also teach classes in canning. You know, you can't eat all those vegetables all in one fell swoop in the season, so you can save some for the winter months.
Sure.
Fermenting. Tell us about that.
Fermenting class is very interesting. You'll learn how to make sauerkraut, which is one of the healthiest probiotic foods that you can eat when it's made by yourself.
Yeah.
It's a lot more healthy because there are no other additives that people put in. So.
Bread making, where do you get the grain?
We buy organic whole wheat. We grind it ourselves. It's also in a class, learn how to make bread. Mm-hmm. Sourdough bread is our specialty, which is in these days gluten-free because the fermentation eats up the gluten in the sourdough bread. So yeah. It's very good for people that are gluten intolerant.
Very nice. And then you teach people how to raise chickens and goats and pigs and all of these other animals we've been talking about also, I presume?
Correct. Yeah. All the intricacies that goes into taking care of these animals and keeping them healthy and productive for their lives and giving them a great life.
Also soap making and lotion making.
Mm-hmm.
Nice.
We do specialized different types of lotion, which are all made from goat milk, mm-hmm. as well as the soaps.
Very good. I understand you also have some construction classes geared toward folks that may be doing a little bit of farming and want to learn how to make things. Tell us about that.
Sure. My background has been in construction for a long time as well as culinary, but I was very interested in alternative building practices. So we have classes in straw bale building and cordwood building, and I've also built a lot of log homes.
Wow.
So that's not too many around here.
Fabulous. And people can also find you teaching in some of our county libraries.
Right. The county libraries have contracted with me to come and teach different classes.
Very cool.
The Crest Library, the Ramona Library.
Yeah. So you can check the San Diego County Library schedule to get the latest classes coming up, listeners.
Correct.
Now, we've saved the best for last. I'm sure a lot of you are wondering, how on earth do you do all this stuff in such a small space? Again, this half-acre farm in Spring Valley and a one-acre one out in Jamul. You can learn more at valleyviewurbanfarm.com, but also very soon, Don is going to be hosting a segment coming up for us on the East County Magazine radio show called Backyard Homesteading.
Correct. Looking forward to sharing my knowledge and wisdom about different things that I've learned and being able to pass it on to you and encourage you to do the same.
Very good. Don, I want to thank you for joining us today on the East County Magazine show on KNSJ. And we're going to end, listeners, by playing the intro to our upcoming backyard homesteading segment that Don Axe is going to be generously hosting for us. So listen up.
Hi, this is Don Axe at Valley View Urban Farm, your host of the Backyard Homestead, your how-to source for urban farming, homesteading, even in a small space, and getting back to our agricultural roots.
Now it's time for the Green Scene Report, highlighting energy, environmental, and sustainability issues in our community.
It's rare for Congress to agree on anything these days, but this week, in a rare show of bipartisanship, Congress voted to officially designate the bison as America's official national mammal. Once millions of bison, also known as buffalo, roamed the American plains until hunters drove the vast herds to near extinction. The bison were hunted for sport, for meat, and to eradicate competitors of cattle and sheep grazing across the West. Now that Congress had made its declaration, the National Wildlife Federation is seeking to take the next step. It's inviting the public to adopt an acre with donations to create a safe habitat for wild bison to once again roam free in the American West.
Don't let your guard down after this wet winter. Rain can't revive the millions of trees that are dead from years of drought. The bark beetle epidemic continues, infesting and killing even more trees. The more dead trees, the greater the threat from wildfires that will have more material to fuel their intensity. Now is the time to create and maintain 100 feet of defensible space around your home by removing dead trees, brush, and vegetation. Learn more from CAL FIRE at readyforwildfire.org.
We're on the road in East County, visiting some amazing towns and meeting some incredible people across our region. Welcome to another adventure on East County Magazine's On the Road.
Next up from County News Service, we're going to be hearing from Larry Johnson out at the old Campo Stone Store, one of East County's most unique and colorful historical landmarks.
If you're ever on Highway 94, about an hour east of San Diego, you might see this unique building.
Welcome to historic Campo and the Gaskell Brothers Stone Store Museum.
The Gaskell Brothers built a fortress-like stone store in 1885. Previously, it was a wooden structure, the site of a famous shootout.
A group of bandits had been raiding down the coast of California, so gunfire started, and there was a big shootout. The guy that they had shot on the floor, one of the Gaskell Brothers, didn't kill him. He jumped up, grabbed a shotgun, went out and shot people, and so they were shooting dead blank range around, and both Gaskell Brothers were wounded. The locals were afraid of another raid. They couldn't get the military up here to guard and protect them, so they thought they needed a substantial building. So that's why they decided to build a building as thick as this and as strong as this. If you take a look around, if you come in, you'll see that the walls down here are about 4 foot thick. It's from stone that was quarried here on site by hand with hammer and drill and no backhoes or heavy lifting objects. It was manpower. It served as a store from 1885 until about 1927.
No longer a store, this building is now a museum, thanks to County Parks and the Mountain Empire Historical Society. Today, the store reflects the early life of the town of Campo.
When the Historical Society began, they tried to make it look a lot like it did in 1899, or when it was a store functioning to serve the local public. So they have gathered some of the food stuff, the tobaccos, the medical supplies, the ropes, the cans, anything that the ranchers needed. If they didn't have it, you didn't need it.
The building is filled with photos, books, artifacts from the Kumeyaay Indians who occupied the region prior to the settlers, and other rare items.
These shackles were found locally about 3 miles from here on a ranch in about 1885. A person who's bought the ranch found in the well the skeleton. On the skeleton, on the legs, were these shackles. They didn't know who the body was or who the skeleton was. It's still a mystery today. One of the interesting things about these shackles is they're blacksmith made. There's no lock to them. Once they were on, they were meant to stay.
Upstairs is an impressive exhibit dedicated to Campo's military history, including Camp Lockett.
Camp Lockett was started before the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor. I guess the military was anticipating that there was going to be a war, and they needed another base here, and they needed a base in this area because of the railroad, which was a key supply line. We had a long exposed border, and one of the things they were afraid of was that if the Japanese came into the war, they might invade Mexico and come into San Diego. So this was sort of a critical point, and so they started building Camp Lockett.
The 10th Cavalry is one you may have heard of.
The famed Buffalo Soldiers, white officers and then African-American enlisted troops. And they were stationed here, and they were guarding tunnels and railroad and the border. Very tough, very good soldiers.
The museum is open on weekends, making for a nice day trip to learn about our local pioneers.
They were entrepreneurs, every one of them. They were constantly trying to figure out how to make the best of what they had and where they were, and to make a living and to leave history and substantial items behind them so that descendants would have something to live and work on and hopefully try and take care of.
This concludes today's episode of East County Magazine's radio show. We extend our appreciation to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County and Descanso. We extend our appreciation to our sound technicians, Leon Thompson and Ed Barena, and to our producer, Miriam Raftery. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Royalty Free Music, Blues 3 Music, and Pond 5. If you have story ideas or would like to underwrite the East County Magazine radio show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org or call 619-698-7617. We'll be back soon for another edition of East County Magazine's radio show.